Galatians chapter 3. Today we'll read verses 15 through 18. It says, "Brothers, I speak in human terms, even though it is only a man's covenant, yet when it has been ratified, no one sets it aside or adds conditions to it. Now the promises were spoken to Abraham and to his seed. He does not say, and to your seeds, as referring to many, but rather to one, and to your seed, that is Christ. What I am saying is this, the law, which came 430 years later, does not invalidate a covenant previously ratified by God so as to abolish the promise. For if the inheritance is by law, it is no longer a promise, but God has granted it to Abraham through promise." Today, as we continue in this very important epistle, we come to this portion of the scripture here, and the title of my sermon is "The Promise by Faith." We've noticed how that Paul is deeply troubled by the Galatian churches and their compromise of the gospel. He's used such strong words as Galatians chapter 3 and verse 1 when he said, "O foolish Galatians, who bewitched you, before whose eyes Jesus Christ was publicly portrayed as crucified." Or earlier, in Galatians chapter 1, verses 6 through 9, when he said, "I marvel that you are so quickly deserting him who called you by the grace of Christ for a different gospel, which is really not another, only there are some who are disturbing you and want to distort the gospel of Christ. But even if we or an angel from heaven should proclaim to you a gospel contrary to the gospel we have proclaimed to you, let him be accursed. As we have said before, so say I now again, if any man is proclaiming to you a gospel contrary to what you received, let him be accursed." As I made mention before in the very beginning, the first sermon, the intro to Galatians, this is the only epistle in which he did not have any commendation or praise for any of their leaders. He had nothing good to say to these churches. He wrote to counter the false teachers who had come in and undermined the central doctrine of justification by faith. But all that being said, all the hard words in which that he wrote, we come here to our text in Galatians chapter 3 in verse 15, and he addresses them as brothers. Brothers. This is a cordial address, is it not? Was Paul upset with them? Absolutely, he was upset. Was he aggravated at the situation? Of course he was. There are things that happened there. They got him upset. But all that being said, Paul had a compassionate love for the churches of Galatia, even though he did have to rebuke them. They weren't paying attention to the things that he had preached. They weren't paying attention to the things that he was saying. They did not follow through with what the foundation that had been laid. They had a sense of apathy or even downright rebellion to the truth. But still, deep down in the apostle's heart, he still regarded them as brothers. You want to know the amount of time that Paul had spent with these people. Understand that they were a Gentile group. But as he's writing here, what's he doing? He's pulling from the Old Testament to counter the Judaizers. He said, well, yeah, that's what you've been telling us. Well, of course, but let's connect the dots a little bit and understand something. That as Gentiles, these people didn't grow up with the Old Testament being read to them. They didn't grow up hearing the Bible stories. They didn't grow up in the synagogues. They didn't grow up in the temple. These were things that were new to them. And so, as he's quoting from the Old Testament, as he's writing to them, telling them about Abraham, and writing about the Old Testament law and all this, he's doing it with the assumption that they know something about it. And the reason he assumes that they know something about it is because of the time, effort, and energy that he and Barnabas and the others who had been with him had taken to teach them the scriptures. But they had not been paying close attention. But they had fallen for the Judaizers. They had been, in his words, bewitched. They were foolish to fall for it. The reality is they didn't need Paul to hold their hand the whole time. Paul needed to move on to other places, but now he has to circle back around to them to remind them of the truths of God's Word. And this was frustrating to him, but he still calls them brothers. The harshness that he wrote to them and the manner that he wrote to them, he wasn't being overbearing. In fact, this is a loving letter. In 1 Corinthians chapter 13, that famous portion of the letter that he wrote to the church at Corinth, about love, notice what it says there. In 1 Corinthians chapter 13, in verse 1, and going down to verse 7. If I speak with the tongues of men and of angels, but do not have love, I become a noisy gong or clanging cymbal. And if I have the gift of prophecy and know all mysteries and all knowledge, if I have all faith so as to remove mountains, but do not have love, I am nothing. If I give all my possessions to feed the poor, if I surrender my body to be burned, but do not have love, it profits me nothing. Love is patient. Love is kind. is not jealous, does not brag, is not puffed up. It does not act unbecomingly, does not seek its own, is not provoked, does not take into account a wrong suffered. It does not rejoice in unrighteousness, but rejoices with the truth. Did you get that? It does not rejoice in unrighteousness, but rejoices with the truth. It bears all things, believes all things, hopes all things, endures all things. It would have been unloving had Paul simply said about the churches of Galatia, "Oh no, you all have gone too far with these false teachers, so I'm going to cut you off. I'm going to cut fellowship from you. I'm not going to have anything to do with you. I'm going to mark you as apostate heretic churches." It would have been unloving for Paul had he, instead of writing to them, he wrote about them. You see, had he instead of writing to the churches of Galatia, instead, if he wrote a letter to the church at Corinth or the church of Jerusalem, he said, "Well, did you see what, or did you hear what's going on at Galatia?" But that's not what he did. We see the loving pattern set forth here. In fact, this is the pattern throughout the New Testament. Baptist churches of today would do well to learn of this pattern. We're not loving the truth when we ostracize, cut off, and slander other churches just for the sake of these things. Paul did love them as brothers. And we see that here with that term, with that endearing term, brothers, in verse 15 of chapter 3. He says, "Brothers, I speak in human terms, even though it is only a man's covenant, yet when it has been ratified, no one sets it aside or adds conditions to it." He begins speaking in human terms such that when a covenant or a contract is made, it is not broken. It cannot be changed by setting forth new terms or setting it aside altogether by adding new stipulations. Such a contract or covenant between men is considered to be unchangeable. We enter into covenants or contracts all the time. "This is the contract that I've made with my service provider, and this is the expectation that we have." Whether it's AT&T or Verizon or whatever. And on we go. "This is the contract, this is the covenant, this is the agreement that I've made with the mortgage company or the car company and the bank and yada, yada, yada." We make these things. We make these agreements. People have been making them for generations and for years. Once the contract is signed, once the agreement is made, once the covenant has been made, the expectation is, even between men, nobody goes back and changes it. How much more a covenant made by God? In fact, when we think about who God is, look there in Malachi chapter 3. Malachi chapter 3, verse 6. Malachi chapter 3 and verse 6, he says, "For I, Yahweh, do not change. Therefore you, O sons of Jacob, are not consumed." Our God, Yahweh, He does not change. In the New Testament, in James chapter 1, James chapter 1 and verse 17. "Every good thing given and every perfect gift is from above, coming down from the Father of lights, with whom there is no variation or shifting shadow." There's no variation or shifting with God. With man, there may be. Now, the expectation is that there won't be. But there sometimes is, isn't there? Treaties are made and they're broken. Contracts are made. They're broken, and so on and so forth. Even though the expectation is that they won't be, the reality is that they sometimes are. But with God, He doesn't change. He doesn't change. God cannot change. So how can His covenants change? This is important when we consider the Abrahamic covenant. A clear reading of the covenant indicates that there were specific promises given, including land promises given. Go with me back to the book of Genesis. Genesis chapter 12. Verses 6 and 7. "And Abram passed through the land as far as the site of Shechem, to the oak of Moreh. Now the Canaanite was then in the land. Then Yahweh appeared to Abram and said, 'To your seed I will give this land.' So he built an altar there to Yahweh who had appeared to him." In fact, there were specific boundaries laid out in these promises that were promised to his descendants over in chapter 13, beginning of verse 14. "And Yahweh said to Abram after that Lot had separated from him, 'Now lift up your eyes and look from the place where you are, northward and southward and eastward and westward, for all the land which you see, I will give it to you and to your seed forever. And I will make your seed as the dust of the earth, so that if anyone can number the dust of the earth, then your seed can also be numbered. Arise, walk about the land through its length and breadth, for I will give it to you.'" Someone says, "Well, Israel has disobeyed and done some pretty terrible things," and that's true. That's true. But in Jeremiah chapter 16, Jeremiah chapter 16, in verse 15, Let's start with verse 14. Therefore, behold, days are coming, declares Yahweh, when it will no longer be said, as Yahweh lives, who brought up the sons of Israel out of the land of Egypt. But as Yahweh lives, who brought up the sons of Israel from the land of the north, from all the lands which he had banished them, for I will return them to their own land, which I gave to their fathers. And so there's a perpetuity to these land promises, that Israel's disobedience does not nullify the promise. That this covenant is sure. And so we get to Galatians chapter 3. Paul says, even though it's even with man's covenants, no one sets aside or adds conditions to it. Verse 16, he says, now the promises were spoken to Abraham and to his seed. He does not say unto seeds as referring to many, but rather to one and to your seed, that is Christ. Now you think just a moment and say, well, these promises, they were given so long ago, but they did not become void when Abraham died or even when the law came. And as Paul is writing this, he's referring back to the Old Testament, drawing from the Scriptures. And he says, when the promises were given to Abraham and to his seed, he does not say unto seeds as referring to many, but rather to one, and to your seed, that is Christ. And you say, well, wait a minute, I thought we just read back there where he said that your seed would be as the dust of the earth. That's a lot. That's true. He did say that. Paul is not saying that all of the times that the word seed has to do with one, but rather he has his sights on one seed. He's got his sights set on the greatest of all of Abraham's descendants, and that is Jesus. And he's referring back to a specific part of the Abrahamic covenant. The part that has to do with Jesus himself. Now, Paul is not saying that Christ is the fulfillment of all the promises of the Abrahamic covenant. In other words, he's not saying that Jesus fulfills the land promises and so on and so forth. But he is saying that the greatest part of the Abrahamic covenant has to do with Jesus. And so what he's referring back to is Genesis chapter 17, for instance. So let's go back there. Genesis chapter 17. Begin at verse 1. Now it happened that when Abram was 99 years old, Yahweh appeared to Abram and said to him, I am God Almighty. Walk before me and be blameless, so that I may confirm my covenant between me and you, that I may multiply you exceedingly. Then Abram fell on his face, and God spoke with him, saying, As for me, behold, my covenant is with you. You will be the father of a multitude of nations. No longer shall your name be called Abram, but your name shall be Abraham, for I have made you the father of a multitude of nations. I will make you exceedingly fruitful, and will make nations of you, and kings shall go forth from you. I will establish my covenant between me and you, and your seed after you throughout their generations for an everlasting covenant to be God to you and to your seed after you. And I will give to you, to your seed after you, the land of your sojournings, all the land of Canaan for an everlasting possession, and I will be their God. You see there, he says about the seed, and not seeds. If you go back just a couple of pages to chapter 15, verses 1 through 4, if we go just a little bit before this, after these things, the word of Yahweh came to Abram in a vision, saying, Do not fear, Abram. I am a shield to you. Your reward shall be very great. Abram said, O Lord Yahweh, what will you give me as I go on being childless? The heir of my house is Eliezer of Damascus. Abram said, Since you have given no seed to me, behold, one born in my house is my heir. Then behold, the word of Yahweh came to him, saying, This one will not be your heir, but one who will come forth from your own body, he shall be your heir. And he brought him outside and said, Now look toward heavens, number the stars, if you are able to number them. He said to him, So shall your seed be. Then he believed in Yahweh, and he counted it to him as righteous. Abram was looking for, for that seed. He was looking for that particular one. And who was that? He was looking for Jesus. You say, how did he know to be looking for Jesus? Well, this goes all the way back to the Garden of Eden. You remember, back yonder in Genesis chapter 3 and verse 15. Genesis 3 and verse 15, it says, And I will put enmity between you and the woman, and between your seed and her seed. He shall bruise you on the head, and you shall bruise him on the heel. And so this seed that was promised, seed of the woman, God promised to Adam that his Redeemer would be the seed of the woman. Abram was looking for that. And this is why, as we study this all the way through, we understand that that's the reason why that this word seed is translated the way it is all the way through. Now, there are some translations who take that word seed and they translate it descendants, But they've missed the point. The point is not descendants. The point is seed. The point is they were looking for Jesus. The point is they were looking for the seed, Jesus. And this thread can be traced in the Hebrew, the Greek, and in the English of a good translation all the way back. And we see that it's not through the law, because this goes before the law. And this is what Paul is bringing up here. This is why he's pointing this out meticulously to those people there in the churches of Galatia. Right? And so back to our text there in Galatians chapter 3. He makes the point very, very clear. The promises were spoken to Abraham and to his seed. He does not say "and to seeds" as referring to many, but rather to one, and to your seed, that is Christ. In verse 17, "And what I am saying is this, the law, which came 430 years later, does not invalidate a covenant previously ratified by God, so as to abolish the promise." The law was being celebrated, being brought up, being talked about so much within the churches of Galatia. But this came 430 years after Abraham. And it doesn't annul the covenant previously ratified by God so as to void out the promise. It doesn't change the promise. The Abrahamic covenant was unilateral. God made the promise to himself. It was eternal. It provided for everlasting blessing. It was irrevocable, in so much that it will never cease. It was unconditional, in that it depended on God, not man. But understand that its complete fulfillment awaits the salvation of Israel and the millennial kingdom of Jesus Christ. And so, we can see how that this is all of grace and not of the law. Verse 18, "For if the inheritance is by the law, it is no longer by promise, but God has granted it to Abraham through promise." This is the clincher. This is the point. The inheritance, it's either by grace or by works. There's no middle ground here. An inheritance, by definition, is something granted and not worked for. Abraham is the example. And these fellows at Galatia, they'd gotten it all twisted up and jumbled up. They thought the circumcision and the keeping of the law and all those things, that was the way, but no, not at all. Not at all. And so in closing, I'd like for us to go over to Romans chapter 4. Romans chapter 4. He says, for verse 14, "For if those who are of the law are heirs, faith hath been made empty, and the promise has been abolished. You can't have a promise coming from the law. It's just not the way it works. You can't have something like an inheritance coming by any way except by grace. And that's what Paul is teaching here by the inspiration of the Spirit. And so whether Jew or Gentile, we have much to be thankful for. So we'll stop there, and Lord willing, next time we'll pick up where we left off.